times. Go on. Well, Ted thinks there's one human being who might make it down to the surface of Europa, because his old friend is there, and may have some influence with the powers that be. Captain Dimitri Chandler gave a long, low whistle. And you're willing to risk it? Yes. What have I got to lose? One valuable shuttlecraft, if I know what you have in mind. Is that why you've been learning to fly Falcon? Well, now that you mention it, the idea had occurred to me. I'll have to think it over. I'll admit I'm intrigued, but there are lots of problems. Knowing you, I'm sure they won't stand in the way, once you've decided to help me. Chapter 22. Venture. Miss Pringle, list priority messages from Earth. Record. Dear Indra, I'm not trying to be dramatic, but this may be my last message from Ganymede. By the time you receive it, I will be on my way to Europa. Though it's a sudden decision, and no one is more surprised than I am, I thought it over very carefully. As you'll have guessed, Ted Kahn is largely responsible. Let him do the explaining, if I don't come back. Please don't misunderstand me. In no way do I regard this as a suicide mission. But I'm 90% convinced by Ted's arguments, and he's aroused my curiosity so much that I'd never forgive myself if I turned down this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Maybe I should say, once in two lifetimes. I'm flying Goliath's little one-person shuttle Falcon. How I'd have loved to demonstrate it to my old colleagues back at the Space Administration. Judging by past records, the most likely outcome is that I'll be diverted away from Europa before I can land. Even this will teach me something. And if it, presumably the local monolith, the Great Wall, decides to treat me like the robot probes it zapped in the past, I'll never know. That's a risk I'm prepared to take. Thank you for everything, and my very best to Joe. Love from Ganymede, and soon, I hope, from Europa. Store. Transmit. Part 4. The Kingdom of Sulphur. Chapter 23. Falcon.
Europa's about 400,000 K from Ganymede at the moment, Captain Chandler informed Poole. If you stepped on the gas, thanks for teaching me that phrase, Falcon could get you there in an hour, but I wouldn't recommend it. Our mysterious friend might be alarmed by anyone coming in that fast.
Agreed. And I want time to think. I'm going to take several hours, at least. And I'm still hoping...
Poole's voice trailed off into silence. Hoping what?
That I can make some sort of contact with Dave, or whatever it is, before I attempt to land.
Yes, it's always rude to drop in uninvited, even with people you know, let alone perfect strangers like the Europs. Perhaps you should take some gifts. What did the old-time explorers use? I believe mirrors and beads were once popular.
Chandler's facetious tone did not disguise his real concern, both for Poole and for the valuable piece of equipment he proposed to borrow, and for which the skipper of Goliath was ultimately responsible.
I'm still trying to decide how we work this. If you come back a hero, I want to bask in your reflected glory, but if you lose Falcon as well as yourself, what shall I say? That you stole the shuttle while we weren't looking? I'm afraid no one would buy that story. Ganymede traffic control is very efficient. Has to be. If you left without advance notice, they'd be on to you in a microsec. Well, a millisecond. No way you could leave unless I file your flight plan ahead of time. So this is what I propose to do, unless I think of something better. You're taking Falcon out for a final qualification test. Everyone knows you've already soloed. You'll go into a 2,000-kilometer-high orbit above Europa. Nothing unusual about that. People do it all the time, and the local authorities don't seem to object. Estimated total flight time, 5 hours plus or minus 10 minutes. If you suddenly change your mind about coming home, no one can do anything about it. At least no one on Ganymede. Of course, I'll make some indignant noises and say how astonished I am by such gross navigational errors, etc., etc. Whatever will look best in the subsequent court of inquiry.
Would it come to that?
I don't want to do anything that will get you into trouble. Don't worry. It's time there was a little excitement around here, but only you and I know about this plot. Try not to mention it to the crew. I want them to have... What was that other useful expression you taught me? Plausible deniability.
Thanks, Tim. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I hope you'll never have to regret hauling me aboard Goliath, out round Neptune.
Poole found it hard to avoid arousing suspicion by the way he behaved towards his new crewmates as they prepared Falcon for what was supposed to be a short, routine flight. Only he and Chandler knew that it might be nothing of the kind. Yet he was not heading into the totally unknown, as he and Dave Bowman had done 1,000 years ago. Stored in the shuttle's memory were high-resolution maps of Europa showing details down to a few meters across. He knew exactly where he wished to go. It only remained to see if he would be allowed to break the centuries-long quarantine.
Chapter 24 Escape.
Manual control, please.
Are you sure, Frank?
Quite sure, Falcon. Thank you. Illogical though it seemed, most of the human race had found it impossible not to be polite to its artificial children, however simple-minded they might be. Whole volumes of psychology, as well as popular guides, how not to hurt your computer's feelings. Artificial Intelligence, Real Irritation, were two of the best-known titles, had been written on the subject of man-machine etiquette. Long ago it had been decided that, however inconsequential rudeness to robots might appear to be, it should be discouraged. All too easily it could spread to human relationships as well. Falcon was now in orbit, just as her flight plan had promised, at a safe 2,000 kilometers above Europa. The giant moon's crescent dominated the sky ahead, and even the area not illuminated by Lucifer was so brilliantly lit by the much more distant sun that every detail was clearly visible. Poole needed no optical aid to see his planned destination on the still icy shore of the Sea of Galilee, not far from the skeleton of the first spacecraft to land on this world. Though the Europans had long ago removed all its metal components, the ill-fated Chinese ship still served as a memorial to its crew, and it was appropriate that the only town, even if an alien one, on this whole world should have been named Tianville. Poole had decided to come down over the sea and then fly very slowly towards Tianville, hoping that this approach would appear friendly, or at least non-aggressive. Though he admitted to himself that this was very naive, he could think of no better alternative. Then, suddenly, just as he was dropping below the 1,000-kilometer level, there was an interruption. Not of the kind he had hoped for, but one which he had been expecting.
"This is Ganymede Control, calling Falcon. You have departed from your flight plan. Please advise immediately what is happening."
It was hard to ignore such an urgent request. But in the circumstances, it seemed the best thing to do. Exactly 30 seconds later, and 100 kilometers closer to Europa, Ganymede repeated its message. Once again, Poole ignored it. But Falcon did not.
"Are you quite sure you want to do this, Frank?" asked the shuttle.
Though Poole knew perfectly well that he was imagining it, he would have sworn there was a note of anxiety in its voice.
"Quite sure, Falcon. I know exactly what I'm doing."
That was certainly untrue, and any moment now further lying might be necessary to a more sophisticated audience. Seldom-activated indicator lights started to flash near the edge of the control board. Poole smiled with satisfaction. Everything was going according to plan.
"This is Ganymede Control. Do you receive me, Falcon? You are operating on manual override, so I am unable to assist you." What is happening? You are still descending towards Europa. Please acknowledge immediately.
Poole began to experience mild twinges of conscience. He thought he recognized the controller's voice, and was almost certain it was a charming lady he had met at a reception given by the mayor soon after his arrival at Anubis. She sounded genuinely alarmed. Suddenly he knew how to relieve her anxiety, as well as to attempt something which he had previously dismissed as altogether too absurd. Perhaps, after all, it was worth a try. It certainly wouldn't do any harm, and it might even work.
This is Frank Poole calling from Falcon. I am perfectly okay, but something seems to have taken over the controls and is bringing the shuttle down towards Europa. I hope you're receiving this. I will continue to report as long as possible.
Well, he hadn't actually lied to the worried controller, and one day he hoped he would be able to face her with a clear conscience. He continued to talk, trying to sound as if he was completely sincere, instead of skirting the edge of truth.
This is Frank Poole aboard the shuttle Falcon descending towards Europa. I assume that some outside force has taken charge of my spacecraft and will be landing it safely.
Dave? This is your old shipmate, Frank. Are you the entity that is controlling me? I have reason to think that you are on Europa. If so, I look forward to meeting you, wherever or whatever you are.
Not for a moment did he imagine there would be any reply. Even Ganymede Control appeared to be shocked into silence, and yet, in a way, he had an answer. Falcon was still being permitted to descend towards the Sea of Galilee. Europa was only 50 kilometers below. With his naked eyes, Poole could now see the narrow black bar where the greatest of the monoliths stood guard, if indeed it was doing that, on the outskirts of Cienville. No human being had been allowed to come so close for 1,000 years.
Chapter 25. Fire in the Deep. For millions of years it had been an ocean world, its hidden waters protected from the vacuum of space by a crust of ice. In most places the ice was kilometers thick, but there were lines of weakness where it had cracked open and torn apart. Then there had been a brief battle between two implacably hostile elements that came into direct contact on no other world in the solar system. The war between sea and space always ended in the same stalemate. The exposed water simultaneously boiled and froze, repairing the armor of ice. The seas of Europa would have frozen completely solid long ago without the influence of nearby Jupiter. Its gravity continually kneaded the core of the little world. The forces that convulsed Io were also working there, though with much less ferocity. Everywhere in the deep was evidence of that tug-of-war between planet and satellite, in the continual roar and thunder of submarine earthquakes, the shriek of gases escaping from the interior, the infrasonic pressure waves of avalanches sweeping over the abyssal plains. By comparison with the tumultuous ocean that covered Europa, even the noisy seas of Earth were muted. Here and there, scattered over the deserts of the deep, were oases that would have amazed and delighted any terrestrial biologist. They extended for several kilometers around tangled masses of pipes and chimneys deposited by mineral brines gushing from the interior. Often they created natural parodies of Gothic castles, from which black, scalding liquids pulsed in a slow rhythm as if driven by the beating of some mighty heart. And, like blood, they were the authentic sign of life itself. The boiling fluids drove back the deadly cold leaking down from above and formed islands of warmth on the seabed. Equally important, they brought from Europa's interior all the chemicals of life. Such fertile oases, offering food and energy in abundance, had been discovered by the 20th century explorers of Earth's oceans. Here they were present on an immensely larger scale and in far greater variety. Delicate, spidery structures,
that seemed to be the analog of plants, flourished in the tropical zones closest to the sources of heat. Crawling among these were bizarre slugs and worms, some feeding on the plants, others obtaining their food directly from the mineral-laden waters around them. At greater distances from the submarine fires around which all these creatures warmed themselves, lived sturdier, more robust organisms, not unlike crabs or spiders. Armies of biologists could have spent a lifetime studying one small oasis. Unlike the Paleozoic terrestrial seas, the European abyss was not a stable environment, so evolution had progressed with astonishing speed, producing multitudes of fantastic forms. And all were under the same indefinite stay of execution. Sooner or later, each fountain of life would weaken and die as the forces that powered it moved their focus elsewhere. All across the European seabed was evidence of such tragedies. Countless circular areas were littered with the skeletons and mineral-encrusted remains of dead creatures, where entire chapters of evolution had been deleted from the Book of Life. Some had left, as their only memorial, huge, empty shells like convoluted trumpets larger than a man. And there were clams of many shapes, bivalves and even trivalves, as well as spiral stone patterns many meters across, exactly like the beautiful ammonites that disappeared so mysteriously from Earth's oceans at the end of the Cretaceous period. Among the greatest wonders of the European abyss were rivers of incandescent lava, pouring from the calderas of submarine volcanoes. The pressure at these depths was so great that the water in contact with the red-hot magma could not flash into steam, so the two liquids coexisted in an uneasy truce. There, on another world, and with alien actors, something like the story of Egypt had been played out long before the coming of man. As the Nile had brought life to a narrow ribbon of desert, so this river of warmth had vivified the European deep. Along its banks, in a band never more than a few kilometers wide, species after species had evolved and flourished and passed away. And some had left permanent monuments. Often they were not easy to distinguish from the natural formations around the thermal vents, and even when they were clearly not due to pure chemistry, one would be hard put to decide whether they were the product of instinct or intelligence. On Earth, the termites reared condominiums almost as impressive as any found in the single vast ocean that enveloped this frozen world. Along the narrow band of fertility in the deserts of the deep, whole cultures and even civilizations might have risen and fallen, armies might have marched or swum under the command of European Tamburlanes or Napoleons, and the rest of their world would never have known, for all their oases were as isolated from one another as the planets themselves. The creatures who basked in the glow of the lava rivers and fed around the hot vents could not cross the hostile wilderness between their lonely islands. If they had ever produced historians and philosophers, each culture would have been convinced that it was alone in the universe. Yet even the space between the oases was not altogether empty of life. There were hardier creatures who had dared its rigors. Some were the European analogues of fish, streamlined torpedoes propelled by vertical tails, steered by fins along their bodies. The resemblance to the most successful dwellers in Earth's oceans was inevitable. Given the same engineering problems, evolution must produce very similar answers. Witness the dolphin and the shark, superficially almost identical, yet from far distant branches of the tree of life. There was, however, one very obvious difference between the fish of the European seas and those in terrestrial oceans. They had no gills, for there was hardly a trace of oxygen to be extracted from the waters in which they swam. Like the creatures around Earth's own geothermal vents, their metabolism was based on sulfur compounds, present in abundance in this volcanic environment. And very few had eyes. Apart from the flickering glow of lava outpourings and occasional bursts of bioluminescence from creatures seeking mates or hunters questing prey, it was a lightless world. It was also a doomed one. Not only were its energy sources sporadic and constantly shifting, but the tidal forces that drove them were steadily weakening. Even if they developed true intelligence, the Europans were trapped between fire and ice. Barring a miracle, they would perish with the final freezing of their little world. Lucifer had wrought that miracle. Chapter 26. Tienville. In the final moments as he came in over the coast at a sedate 100 kilometers an hour, Poole wondered if there might be some last-minute intervention, but nothing untoward happened. Even when he moved slowly along the black, forbidding face of the Great Wall. It was the inevitable name for the Europa monolith, as, unlike its little brothers on Earth and Moon, it was lying horizontally and was more than 20 kilometers long. Although it was literally billions of times greater in volume than TMA-0 and TMA-1, its proportions were exactly the same. That intriguing ratio, 1:4:9, inspirer of so much numerological nonsense over the centuries. As the vertical face was almost 10 kilometers high, one plausible theory maintained that among its other functions, the Great Wall served as a windbreak, protecting Tienville from the ferocious gales that occasionally roared in from the Sea of Galilee. They were much less frequent now that the climate had stabilized, but 1,000 years earlier, they would have been a severe discouragement to any life forms emerging from the ocean. Though he had fully intended to do so, Poole had never found time to visit the Tycho monolith, still top secret when he had left for Jupiter, and Earth's gravity made its twin at Olduvai inaccessible to him. But he had seen their images so often that they were much more familiar than the proverbial back of the hand. And how many people, he had often wondered, would recognize the backs of their hands? Apart from the enormous difference in scale, there was absolutely no way of distinguishing the Great Wall from TMA-1 and TMA-0, or, for that matter, the Big Brother monolith that Discovery and the Leonov had encountered orbiting Jupiter. According to some theories, perhaps crazy enough to be true, there was only one archetypal monolith, and all the others, whatever their size, were merely projections or images of it. Poole recalled these ideas when he noticed the spotless, unsullied smoothness of the Great Wall's towering ebon face. Surely after so many centuries in such a hostile environment, it should have collected a few patches of grime. Yet it looked as immaculate as if an army of window cleaners had just polished every square centimeter. Then he recalled that although everyone who had ever come to view TMA-1 and TMA-0 felt an irresistible urge to touch their apparently pristine surfaces, no one had ever succeeded. Fingers, diamond drills, laser knives all skidded across the monoliths as if they were coated by an impenetrable film. Or as if, and this was another popular theory, they were not quite in this universe, but somehow separated from it by an utterly impassable fraction of a millimeter. He made one complete leisurely circuit of the Great Wall, which remained totally indifferent to his progress. Then he brought the shuttle, still on manual, in case Ganymede Control made any further attempts to rescue him, to the outer limits of Tienville, and hovered there, looking for the best place to land. The scene through Falcon's small panoramic window was wholly familiar to him. He had examined it so often in Ganymede recordings, never imagining that one day he would be observing it in reality. The Europs, it seemed, had no idea of town planning. Hundreds of hemispherical structures were scattered apparently at random over an area about 1 kilometer across. Some were so small that even human children would feel cramped in them, though others were big enough to hold a large family. None was more than 5 meters high. And they were all made from the same material, which gleamed a ghostly white in the double daylight. On Earth, the Eskimo had found the identical answer to the challenge of their own frigid, materials-poor environment. Tienville's igloos were also made of ice. In lieu of streets, there were canals, as best suited creatures who were still amphibious and apparently returned to the water to sleep. Also, it was believed, to feed and to mate, though neither hypothesis had been proved. Tienville had been called Venice made of ice, and Poole had to agree that it was an apt description. However, there were no Venetians in sight. The place looked as if it had been deserted for years. And here was another mystery. Despite the fact that Lucifer was 50 times brighter than the distant sun and was a permanent fixture in the sky, the Europe still seemed locked to an ancient rhythm of night and day. They returned to the ocean at sunset and emerged with the rising of the sun, despite the fact that the level of illumination had changed by only a few percent. Perhaps there was a parallel on Earth, where the life cycles of many creatures were controlled as much by the feeble moon as the far more brilliant sun. It would be sunrise in another hour, and then the inhabitants of Tienville would return to land and go about their leisurely affairs, as, by human standards, they certainly were. The sulfur-based biochemistry that powered the Europs was not as efficient as the oxygen-driven one that energized the vast majority of terrestrial animals. Even a sloth could outrun a Europe, so it was difficult to regard them as potentially dangerous. That was the good news. The bad news was that even with the best intentions on both sides, attempts at communication would be extremely slow, perhaps intolerably tedious. It was about time, Poole decided, that he reported back to Ganymede Control. They must be getting very anxious, and he wondered how his co-conspirator, Captain Chandler, was dealing with the situation.
Falcon calling Ganymede. As you can doubtless see, I have, been brought to rest just above Tienville. There is no sign of hostility, and as it's still solar night here, all the Europs are underwater. We'll call you again as soon as I'm on the ground.
Dim would have been proud of him, Poole thought, as he brought Falcon down gently as a snowflake on a smooth patch of ice. He was taking no chances with its stability, and set the inertial drive to cancel all but a fraction of the shuttle's weight, just enough, he hoped, to prevent it being blown away by any wind. He was on Europa. The first human in 1,000 years. Had Armstrong and Aldrin felt this sense of elation when Eagle touched down on the moon? Probably they were too busy checking their lunar module's primitive and totally unintelligent systems. Falcon, of course, was doing all this automatically. The little cabin was now very quiet, apart from the inevitable and reassuring murmur of well-tempered electronics. It gave Poole a considerable shock when Chandler's voice, obviously pre-recorded, interrupted his thoughts.
So you made it. Congratulations. As you know, we're scheduled to return to the belt week after next, but that should give you plenty of time. After 5 days, Falcon knows what to do. She'll find her way home with or without you. So, good luck.
Miss Pringle. Activate crypto program. Store.
Hello, Dim. Thanks for that cheerful message. I feel rather silly using this program, as if I'm a secret agent in one of the spy melodramas that used to be so popular before I was born. Still, it will allow some privacy, which may be useful. Hope Miss Pringle has downloaded it properly. Of course, Miss P, I'm only joking. By the way, I'm getting a barrage of requests from all the news media in the solar system.
Please try to hold them off, or divert them to Dr. Ted. He'll enjoy handling them. Since Ganymede has me on camera all the time, I won't waste breath telling you what I'm seeing. If all goes well, we should have some action in a few minutes, and we'll know if it really was a good idea to let the Europs find me already sitting here peacefully, waiting to greet them when they come to the surface. Whatever happens, it won't be as big a surprise to me as it was to Dr. Chang and his colleagues when they landed here 1,000 years ago. I played his famous last message again, just before leaving Ganymede. I must confess, it gave me an eerie feeling. Couldn't help wondering if something like that could possibly happen again. Wouldn't like to immortalize myself the way poor Chang did. Of course, I can always lift off if something starts going wrong. And here's an interesting thought that's just occurred to me. I wonder if the Europs have any history, any kind of records, any memory of what happened just a few kilometers from here, 1,000 years ago.
Chapter 27 Ice and Vacuum.
This is Dr. Chang calling from Europa. I hope you can hear me, especially Dr. Floyd. I know you're aboard, Leonov. I may not have much time. Aiming my suit antenna where I think you are. Please relay this information to Earth. Tien was destroyed 3 hours ago. I'm the only survivor. Using my suit radio. No idea if it has enough range, but it's the only chance. Please, listen carefully. There is life on Europa. I repeat, there is life on Europa. We landed safely, checked all the systems, and ran out the hoses so we could start pumping water into our propellant tanks immediately, just in case we had to leave in a hurry. Everything was going according to plan. It seemed almost too good to be true. The tanks were half full when Dr. Li and I went out to check the pipe insulation. Tian stands, stood, about 30 meters from the edge of the Grand Canal. Pipes went directly from it and down through the ice. Very thin. Not safe to walk on. Jupiter was quarter full, and we had 5 kilowatts of lighting strung up on the ship. She looked like a Christmas tree. Beautiful, reflected on the ice. Lee saw it first. A huge dark mass rising up from the depths. At first we thought it was a school of fish, too large for a single organism. Then it started to break through the ice and began moving towards us. It looked rather like huge strands of wet seaweed crawling along the ground. Lee ran back to the ship to get a camera. I stayed to watch, reporting over the radio. The thing moved so slowly I could easily outrun it. I was much more excited than alarmed. Thought I knew what kind of creature it was. I've seen pictures of the kelp forests off California. But I was quite wrong. I could tell it was in trouble. It couldn't possibly survive at a temperature 150 below its normal environment. It was freezing solid as it moved forward. Bits were breaking off like glass. But it was still advancing towards the ship. A black tidal wave, slowing down all the time. I was still so surprised that I couldn't think straight, and I couldn't imagine what it was trying to do. Even though it was heading towards Tien, it still seemed completely harmless, like, well, a small forest on the move. I remember smiling. It reminded me of Macbeth's Birnam Wood. Then I suddenly realized the danger. Even if it was completely inoffensive, it was heavy. With all the ice it was carrying, it must have weighed several tons, even in this low gravity. And it was slowly, painfully, climbing up our landing gear. The legs were beginning to buckle, all in slow motion, like something in a dream or a nightmare. Not until the ship started to topple did I realize what the thing was trying to do, and then it was far too late. We could have saved ourselves if we'd only switched off our lights.
Perhaps it's a phototrope. Its biological cycle triggered by the sunlight that filters down through the ice. Or it could have been attracted like a moth to a candle. Our floodlights must have been more brilliant than anything that Europa has ever known. Even the sun itself. Then the ship crashed. I saw the hull split, a cloud of snowflakes form as moisture condensed. All the lights went out except for one, swinging back and forth on a cable a couple of meters above the ground. I don't know what happened immediately after that. The next thing I remember, I was standing under the light, beside the wreck of the ship, with a fine powdering of fresh snow all around me. I could see my footsteps in it very clearly. I must have run there, perhaps only a minute or two had elapsed. The plant, I still thought of it as a plant, was motionless. I wondered if it had been damaged by the impact. Large sections, as thick as a man's arms, had splintered off like broken twigs. Then the main trunk started to move again. It pulled away from the hull and began to crawl towards me. That was when I knew for certain that the thing was light-sensitive. I was standing immediately under the 1,000-watt lamp, which had stopped swinging now. Imagine an oak tree, better still, a banyan, with its multiple trunks and roots, flattened out by gravity and trying to creep along the ground. It got to within 5 meters of the light, then started to spread out until it had made a perfect circle around me. Presumably, that was the limit of its tolerance, the point at which photoattraction turned to repulsion. After that, nothing happened for several minutes. I wondered if it was dead, frozen solid at last. Then I saw that large buds were forming on many of the branches. It was like watching a time-lapse film of flowers opening. In fact, I thought they were flowers, each about as big as a man's head. Delicate, beautifully colored membranes started to unfold. Even then it occurred to me that no one, no thing, could ever have seen these colors properly until we brought our lights, our fatal lights, to this world. Tendrils, stamens, waving feebly. I walked over to the living wall that surrounded me so that I could see exactly what was happening. Neither then, nor at any other time, had I felt the slightest fear of the creature. I was certain that it was not malevolent, if indeed it was conscious at all. There were scores of the big flowers in various stages of unfolding. Now they reminded me of butterflies just emerging from the chrysalis, wings crumpled, still feeble. I was getting closer and closer to the truth, but they were freezing, dying as quickly as they formed. Then, one after another, they dropped off from the parent buds. For a few moments they flopped around like fish stranded on dry land, and at last I realized exactly what they were. Those membranes weren't petals. They were fins, or their equivalent. This was the free-swimming, larval stage of the creature. Probably it spends much of its life rooted on the seabed, then sends these mobile offspring in search of new territory, just like the corals of Earth's oceans. I knelt down to get a closer look at one of the little creatures. The beautiful colors were fading now to a drab brown. Some of the petal fins had snapped off, becoming brittle shards as they froze. But it was still moving feebly, and as I approached it, it tried to avoid me. I wondered how it sensed my presence. Then I noticed that the stamens, as I'd called them, all carried bright blue dots at their tips. They looked like tiny star sapphires, or the blue eyes along the mantle of a scallop, aware of light, but unable to form true images. As I watched, the vivid blue faded, the gems became dull, ordinary stones. Dr. Floyd, or anyone else who is listening, I haven't much more time. My life support system alarm has just sounded, but I've almost finished.
I knew then what I had to do. The cable to that 1,000-watt lamp was hanging almost to the ground. I gave it a few tugs, and the light went out in a shower of sparks. I wondered whether it was too late. For a few minutes, nothing happened. So I walked over to the wall of tangled branches around me and kicked it. Slowly, the creature started to unweave itself and to retreat back to the canal. I followed it all the way back to the water, encouraging it with more kicks when it slowed down, feeling the fragments of ice crunching all the time beneath my boots. As it neared the canal, it seemed to gain strength and energy, as if it knew it was approaching its natural home. I wondered if it would survive to bud again. It disappeared through the surface, leaving a few last dead larvae on the alien land. The exposed free water bubbled for a few minutes, until a scab of protective ice sealed it from the vacuum above. Then I walked back to the ship to see if there was anything to salvage. I don't want to talk about that. I've only two requests to make, Doctor. When the taxonomists classify this creature, I hope they'll name it after me. And when the next ship comes home, ask them to take our bones back to China. I'll lose power in a few minutes. Wish I knew whether anyone was receiving me. Anyway, I'll repeat this message as long as I can. This is Professor Chang on Europa, reporting the destruction of the spaceship Tien. We landed beside the Grand Canal and set up our pumps at the edge of the ice.
Chapter 28. The Little Dawn. Miss Pringle, record. Here comes the sun. Strange how quickly it seems to rise on this slowly turning world. Of course, the disk's so small that the whole of it pops above the horizon in no time. Not that it makes much difference to the light. If you weren't looking in that direction, you'd never notice that there was another sun in the sky. But I hope the Europs have noticed. Usually it takes them less than 5 minutes to start coming ashore after the little dawn. Wonder if they already know I'm here and are scared. No, could be the other way round. Perhaps they're inquisitive, even anxious to see what strange visitor has come to Tsienville. I rather hope so. Here they come. Hope your spy sats are watching. Falcon's camera's recording. How slowly they move. I'm afraid it's going to be very boring trying to communicate with them, even if they want to talk to me. Rather like the thing that overturned Tsien, but much smaller. They remind me of little trees, walking on half a dozen slender trunks, and with hundreds of branches dividing into twigs, which divide again and again, just like many of our general-purpose robots. What a long time it took us to realize that imitation humanoids were ridiculously clumsy, and the proper way to go was with myriad of small manipulators. Whenever we invent something clever, we find that Mother Nature's already thought of it. Aren't the little ones cute? Like tiny bushes on the move. Wonder how they reproduce. Budding? I hadn't realized how beautiful they are. Almost as colorful as coral reef fish, maybe for the same reasons. To attract mates, or fool predators by pretending to be something else. Did I say they looked like bushes? Make that rose bushes. They've actually got thorns. Must have a good reason for them. I'm disappointed. They don't seem to have noticed me. They're all heading into town. As if a visiting spacecraft was an everyday occurrence. Only a few left. Maybe this will work. I suppose they can detect sound vibrations. Most marine creatures can, though this atmosphere may be too thin to carry my voice very far. Falcon, external speaker. Hello? Can you hear me? My name is Frank Poole. I come in peace for all mankind.
makes me feel rather stupid. But can you suggest anything better? And it will be good for the record.
Nobody's taking the slightest notice.
Big ones and little ones, they're all creeping towards their igloos.
Wonder what they actually do when they get there.
Perhaps I should follow. I'm sure it would be perfectly safe. I can move so much faster. I've just had an amusing flashback. All these creatures going in the same direction, they look like the commuters who used to surge back and forth twice a day between home and office before electronics made it unnecessary. Let's try again before they all disappear.
Hello there! This is Frank Poole, a visitor from planet Earth. Can you hear me?
I hear you, Frank. This is Dave. Chapter 29 The Ghosts in the Machine. Frank Poole's immediate reaction was one of utter astonishment, followed by overwhelming joy. He had never really believed that he would make any kind of contact, either with the Europs or the Monolith. Indeed, he had even had fantasies of kicking in frustration against that towering ebon wall and shouting angrily, "Is there anybody home?" Yet he should not have been so amazed. Some intelligence must have monitored his approach from Ganymede and permitted him